Thanks, Rico. Appreciate that. And we're going to be continuing with what we've been looking at, well, starting last Wednesday and then this morning with the destruction of Jerusalem and all of that. And I had Rico read those two passages for a specific reason. We'll get to that in a moment. But just bear in mind what is going on when God is executing his judgment upon Jerusalem. So let's bear that in mind as we go through our study. For those that are visiting, we are grateful for your attendance, for your being here with us. We're always encouraged by those who set aside time when they're away from home to be with family, to be with Christians, to be with those of like precious faith. And we are truly grateful for your attendance here. And this is a bit out of the norm. There's a lot more lecture, a lot more history involved with this, but we're going to get to the point of it all. I remember a professor of mine in college. The one question he would always ask is, so what? And that is a great question to ask when we're going through all of these things. So what? What does this all mean? What's the point of learning all of this? And we'll go through that as we continue. But we've been talking about this war with Jerusalem, with Rome, with everything. And, well, the other thing I learned from that professor, and I love this, me being the historian that I am, what is the one question everybody asks in a history class? Do we have to know dates? And I remember his answer. He's like, it's a history class, of course you need to know dates. I love that. The dates are important as we go through this. Note that year that everything comes to a head is 66. Keep that in mind. Well, violence begins in Caesarea, which was the capital of the province, and there was a flare-up. You have this merchant house. They're sacrificing these birds in front of the local synagogue, and it goes over about as well as you would expect sacrifices to a pagan deity taking place in front of a Jewish synagogue. Well, in response to that, one of the Jewish temple clerks, Eliezer, and we mentioned him before, he stops offering prayers and sacrifices for the emperor at the temple. Not a good thing. He's the son of Ananias, the former high priest. He's the one who had James killed in Acts chapter 12. So now, in addition to everything that's going on, you've got the civil war in Jerusalem, you've got all of the things that are going to be taking place in Rome, now you've got tax protests. This is an absolute powder keg just waiting to explode. And it all happens fast. The book of Acts ends in roughly the year 62. We're 4 years after that. If you had told somebody living in 62, and basically in Acts chapter 29, if there was such a thing, that these things are going to take place within the next decade, nobody would have believed it. If you wanted to make a movie out of this, the first response is, no, seriously. Because nobody would believe all of this that's happening. And all of a sudden you have this trust, this mutual trust between Rome and Jerusalem, gone. And so basically the Romans, to quell all of this, do what Romans do very well. They come in and basically run roughshod over things. So you have this incredible confluence of events. Florus, he was the governor of Judea. He takes this money from the temple, 17 talents worth. He claims the money's for the emperor. And, well, guess what the Jews decide to do? They're going to pass the basket around for poor Florus. He needs all of this money for the emperor. And they're mocking him and such. So he sends soldiers into the city to arrest the city leaders. Many of them are crucified, even though they were Roman citizens. Roman citizenship was a big deal. And so you have the governors breaking these Roman laws and all of this. So understanding the depth of what's going on, Herod Agrippa, the king, he's the king in Acts 25 and 26 when Paul is on trial. He and his sister Bernice, they flee Jerusalem, head to Galilee. They get out of Dodge. So you have this initial conflict. It's all between what's the response to what Rome does. Do we side with Rome? Do we side with those who are rebelling? Remember the passages we just read a moment ago. So this leads to this huge flare-up, and among those that are killed are the high priest Ananias. And in response to this, you have Gallus, who is the legion commander, the legate of Syria. He assembles some 30,000 soldiers, marches through Galilee, Caesarea, Joppa, all of these places. They surround Jerusalem. Think back to what we talked about in Matthew 24 and Luke 21. When the army surround Jerusalem, what do? Get out. But for whatever reason, they withdraw. We still don't know why. There's some conjecture that maybe Gallus was sick or something like that. But they wind up going back to the coast. And the Roman legion is ambushed and defeated by the Jewish rebels. There were 6,000 troops that were killed, a lot more that were wounded. And it was one of the worst defeats ever for Rome at the hands of a rebel province. And the 12th Legion lost its aquila, its standard, the eagle that was the that went before them. And Gallus' troops flee to Syria. That aquila is huge. You did not do that to Rome. To the Roman leaders, the aquila was more important than the soldiers. You didn't have to come back, but that standard better. And if they didn't, they would move heaven and earth to find it, to recover it. You were dispensable. The aquila was not. The previous time that this had occurred was 57 years before that, Teutoburg Forest. That is a date that is of great importance to Rome. That defined the northern boundary in what is now modern Germany. This battle at Teutoburg Forest, that's what gives rise to German nationalism. Hitler, among others, viewed himself as the successor to the Roman Empire, and it stems from that battle. It was the worst loss in Roman history until the sacking of the city in 476. They lost three standards, three aquila, during that time. They got two of them back in the teens. Another one they got back in 41. It took them 32 years to get that standard back, but they got it back. That's how important that was to Rome. So bear in mind that the Jews, when they ambushed the Romans, took that standard, that aquila. You know our modern presentation of colors in the military? It has its roots in that. The color guard and all of that, the presentation, has its roots in this. Same thing with your various processionals, your entries with your various Catholic denominations, whether it's the Romans or the Anglicans or what have you. But when they come down the aisle, it has its roots with this. There were some things that Rome took exceptionally seriously, and this is one of them. Well, what happens is that Nero, the emperor, he appoints Vespasian, a relatively unknown general. He's given him 60,000 troops to crush this rebellion. Goes through Galilee. There are 100,000 Jews that are killed, sold into slavery. The zealot leaders, and we talked about them before, these that were so opposed to Roman rule over Judea and Jerusalem, they escaped to Jerusalem, and you've got this internal civil war in Jerusalem. Turn to Matthew chapter 24. And it is fascinating to go through this history and to see how Matthew 24 is fulfilled. Verse 9, then they will deliver you up to tribulation and kill you, and you will be hated by all nations for my name's sake. And then many will be offended, will betray one another, and will hate one another. The very definition of civil war. That's what's going on. Brother against brother, friend against friend, and all of this. There are messages that get to one of the rebel groups that they've made a pact with the Roman army, that there's going to be a surrender. And if you're opposed to surrender, now you've got this other faction saying there's going to be a surrender. Who do you turn to? The Idumeans. The Edomites. Think about how desperate they are to maintain possession of the temple and of Jerusalem, that they're turning to their most hated enemy, the Edomites. And you have this siege. 12,000 are killed in that siege alone. Well, in the middle of 68, Nero gets increasingly mad, and the powers that be kick him out. the Senate, the Praetorian Guard, all the prominent military commanders, they plot him out of the emperorship. He's declared an enemy of the people. He flees and basically commits suicide before they kill him. You've got this new emperor, Galba. And bear in mind that Judea is on the far eastern side of the empire. Galba's in Spain on the far western side of the empire. And everything goes to pot in that year, 68 to 69. Summer of Nero's deposed basically in June of 68. And for about the next 18 months or so, you've got four emperors all within that 18-month span. And Otho kills Alba, Vitellius kills Otho. Roman emperors typically did not die of natural causes. In 69, really in the summer of 69, Vespasian is hailed as emperor by the legions under his command. He was relatively nondescript. He had been a governor, so he actually was a relatively honest guy. He's one of the few that didn't make a buck when he was governor of various places. And he goes to claim his title from Vitellius and leaves his son Titus to finish the war in Judea. A bust of Vespasian there. And this is what Rome looked like in 68 and 69. You've got basically these four that have carved out their territories. You've got Galba and such over in Spain, and you've got Vespasian in Syria and Judea and a few other places. And you've got this, well, nature abhors a vacuum. And when you don't leave a successor, there's this vacuum. And that's what happened with Rome. So you've got civil war in Rome. You've got civil war in Jerusalem. You've got civil wars everywhere, it seems like. All of a sudden, now the Roman army in Jerusalem, that's not just some general, that's now the emperor. Wait a minute here. Hold on a second. He went from being fairly nondescript, now he's the emperor? And what does any politician need to secure his legitimacy? I need a win, a victory. Guess where that's going to come from? And because of Rome's military background and such, the best way, the surest way to do that is to establish political legitimacy, win the war. So basically, Titus's instruction is to win quickly, to win as decisively as you can. Cost does not matter. I don't care how you do it, win. And so it didn't matter how many Roman soldiers were lost. We've got enough. Win the war. So all of the pressure on Titus was political. Win quickly, win decisively, win. So now this siege stalemates. Roman troops dig a trench around the city, around the walls. They built another wall. Basically, you have this no man's land, if you will. Anyone caught in that trench gets crucified. The Romans were good at crucifixion, and they killed a lot. We have reports of them doing up to 500 crucifixions in a day. They were good at it. Well, these zealot leaders, remember this civil war? They only unite when basically the Roman troops start building these ramparts. When they start, they're coming after all of us now. That's when they unite, kinda. Well, during the infighting, these zealots burn the food supplies. Think about that for a moment. They burn the food supplies within the city walls. The logic behind that was to motivate those defending to fight Rome and not surrender. So instead of achieving peace, what they wind up doing is killing everybody in the city. You had all these people living in Jerusalem and all these soldiers dying of starvation because all the food supplies had been ruined. In Matthew 24, verse 22, "And unless those days were shortened, no flesh would be saved, but for the elect's sake, those days will be shortened." It was the zealot leaders who shortened the days of the siege. by burning the food supplies as they did. There was a 7th month siege. Titus uses the collapse of several city walls to then go in and ransack and burn the city. The temple fell on the 9th of Av, which was the traditional date of when Solomon's temple was destroyed in 586. That is a huge date in Jewish history. That is the traditional date of mourning. Think Friday the 13th to the 1000th degree, and that's what we're talking about with the 9th of Av. According to Josephus, and we really don't have any reason to think that he would embellish this, Titus had not intended to destroy the temple. The Romans did not want to do that. They did not glory in destroying temples. What they wanted was for your local deity, whoever it to be, to then incorporate the worship of Roman gods and Roman deities in with that. The usage of local religion was a way to pacify the people and to kind of keep them at bay. So they didn't want to destroy the temple. But once the temple in Jerusalem is destroyed, what choice has Titus got other than to celebrate? He can't say, well, we didn't mean to. You mean the greatest military on earth just committed a blunder of epic proportions? No. Let's put it this way. A politician will more readily admit to virtually every sin you can think of, except that one. This would be absolutely sacrilegious for the Romans to admit that. But the Romans do know how to celebrate victory. There's a bust of Titus there. Bear in mind that Titus is Vespasian's son. And the Arch of Titus there in Rome. That is basically the model for future arches. If you've ever been to Paris, the Arc de Triomphe, that's what that is based off of. And Napoleon fancied himself as another Roman emperor. Lots of people claim to be the emperor of Rome, and there's always wanting to get the band back together, so to speak. It is fascinating how much that plays into the minds of the world at large. And it doesn't show up especially well blown up like this, but that is one of the friezes on the inside of the arch. That menorah that is there is the basis for the symbol of the emblem of the modern state of Israel, which has nothing to do with ancient Israel other than the name and the basic geographic location. But that was the model was, and this is depicting them taking the spoils from Jerusalem back to Rome. Well, a very interesting book that I highly recommend, by the name of Martin Goodman, wrote a book called Rome and Jerusalem, and it goes into all of this. And I like how he summarized it. The outcome of the war seems to have been very different from that intended by the Romans in 66, a campaign that had begun in order to ensure that the Jews should offer regular sacrifices to their God in Jerusalem for the well-being of the emperor, had ended by making any such offering impossible. The destruction in Jerusalem in 70 was the product of no long-term policy on either side. It had come about through a combination of accidents, most of them unrelated in origin to the conflict, the death of Nero leading to Vespasian's bid for power, and Titus's quest for the propaganda coup of a rapid conquest of Jerusalem and the devastating effect in the summer heat of a firebrand thrown by a soldier into the temple of God. You had a whole bunch of accidents and things that happened very quickly, and all of a sudden Jerusalem is destroyed and the temple is gone. Huh? And it happened fast. That's what God's judgment looks like. This is what the end of the world looks like. So what were the consequences of this? According to Josephus, you had 1.1 million that were killed during the siege. Many were at the hands of Jews and illness brought on by hunger. Nearly 100,000 were captured and enslaved. The temple was destroyed. The synagogue now becomes much more important. The Sadducees, the priest class, completely wiped out. We basically have no more record of them at all. And the Pharisees, the rabbis, the teachers, the lawyer class, they now increase. There was also the Jewish tax. Exodus chapter 30 and verse 13, it talks about the half shekel that was to be paid for the upkeep of the tabernacle, of the sanctuary. Well, there's no more temple in Jerusalem, so the Romans say, you know that half shekel? We're not going to pay for the upkeep of the
Temple of Jupiter.
Oh, you know when the Temple of Jupiter was destroyed? In 69. So the events going on in Jerusalem during all this time, the consequences of was paying this tax of a temple that had burned after all this had already started. So instead of that tax going towards the Lord's temple, it's now going to Jupiter's temple and the Roman religion. Prior to this point, Rome had viewed Christians as basically a part of the Jews, as a sect of Judaism. Now the Christians petitioned the emperor, "We don't want to pay this tax. Who wants to pay more in taxes? I don't know about you, I don't. So we're going to petition to be separated from that." This tax ended formally in 361. Julian the Apostate, he was the last pagan emperor of Rome, and he basically had been born, quote, Christian, and he converts to paganism, and as a way to get back at the Christians, he's going to eliminate this Jewish tax, and he's going to rebuild the temple. Well, there's an earthquake that happens. The temple never gets rebuilt, obviously, and he dies shortly thereafter, and, quote, Christianity becomes the official religion of Rome in 380. Oh, whatever happened to all that money? That's what you might be familiar with, that edifice there, the Colosseum in Rome, the largest amphitheater in history. If they could bring that up to code, it would be bigger. It would be in the top 10 as far as size-wise for NFL stadiums. Hold about 65,000 people. Basically, Vespasian's cut from looting Jerusalem was used to finance the Colosseum. So all that finery from the temple, that's where it ended up. Domitian, we referenced him. Vespasian's other son who became emperor after Titus. Trajan, we're going to talk about him in a moment, because we saw the destruction in 70. But wait, there's more. That didn't do it. There was still more to come. Trajan was the emperor when Rome reached its zenith in the early 2nd century. We showed this map earlier. 117. Trajan dies in 117, and Rome is at its height of its power, of its glory, of its extent at this time. Hadrian becomes the emperor, and if you look way up in that far northwestern corner, where that kind of deep red ends, that's Hadrian's Wall, which was built, well, really, that marker would come a few years later, in the 120s. So Rome is defined by its size here, and the statue of Hadrian that was unearthed there in Jerusalem, celebrating the Bar Kokhba rebellion, which began in 132 through 135. Hadrian's Wall, there in Britain. Well, there was relative peace, as best there could be, until about 130. Hadrian makes the decision to rebuild the city, but he's not going to rebuild Jerusalem as Jerusalem. It's not going to be Aelia Capitolina, derived from his own family name. He's literally wiping Jerusalem off the map. Same thing with the Judean province. And this, and there were some other sanctions against the Jews, leads to this other revolt. And that war ended in 135 with a ban on the Jewish faith empire-wide. It was lifted upon Hadrian's death, which was in 138. Just like we saw earlier in the 60s with the coins, we now see similar coinage here. The Jews are agitating for independence. They want that independence from Rome. This one has the text to the freedom of Jerusalem. And again, year two of the freedom of Israel, from about 133. And this is showing coinage that was circulating around 130 with the new provincial name, the new city name. Well, the Jews felt betrayed that Hadrian had gone back on rebuilding the temple, and that it's now going to be rebuilt as a pagan temple. So you've got this revolt. There is some independence that's declared for a couple of years, kinda. And this man, Simon Bar Kokhba, takes the title of Nasi, prince. We talked about that before. He was viewed by many Jews as Messiah. He's going to lead this political redemption. We're going to get our independence from him. Well, Hadrian assembles a force of about 6 legions, parts of 6 others, about 80,000 Roman soldiers. They were there to do a number on the people in Jerusalem and in Judea. Rome suffered some initial losses, and then it got personal. And they absolutely destroyed them. It became one of all-out annihilation, the military equivalent of a crime of passion. They went after them like a scorned lover, which, if you're familiar with your Old Testament imagery, was what happened. The Lord, working through Rome, went after them like a scorned lover. It was personal. The last Judean stronghold came under siege in 135. According to Jewish tradition, it was breached on the 9th of Av, Tisha B'Av, the day of mourning for the loss of both temples. Remember when the war started? That first war started in 66? 135, that's 70 years. At that point, the Jews realized the temple is not being rebuilt. This was the end of the practice of Judaism as we understand it. Yes, the records had been destroyed with the original temple, but there were enough people there that knew who the priests were, and they could still claim some lineage, but now you're getting 3 generations removed from that. And all that institutional memory is gone. Modern historians refer to this as a genocide or a holocaust, we would say. Rome basically went on a rampage of systematic killing, removing all traces of Judaism. And there's an interesting passage from the Jerusalem Talmud, from the writings, that the number of dead in Batar was enormous, that the Romans went on killing until their horses were submerged in blood to their nostrils. Turn over to Revelation chapter 14. In verse 20, very last verse of Revelation 14. And the winepress was trampled outside the city, and blood came out of the winepress up to the horses' bridles for 1,600 furlongs. And it's interesting seeing that image carried over in the Talmud here. So some of the consequences. Jerusalem and Judea eliminated from the map. Palestine, which was the Greek for the land of the Philistines, is now the new provincial name. The Jews were banished from the province except for one day out of the year, Tisha B'Av, the anniversary, the commemoration of when the temples were destroyed. This is the practical ending of the Levitical Code. There's no more records, there's no more living witnesses, no living memory or anything like that. 580,000 Jews were killed, many more died of hunger and disease. Rome suffered huge losses, at least one legion, probably others were disbanded or greatly reduced. And it was at this point that the Jews stopped looking for that physical restoration of the Davidic kingdom that we have been focused on so much throughout our studies of the New Testament. So much, that's what we were talking about with Matthew 24, throughout our study of Mark, throughout Revelation, throughout all of this. We see now the rise of Rabbinic Judaism. The Judaism as we know it today comes from this revolt in 135. So what's this got to do with the price of eggs? What do we learn from this? Well, we see the fulfillment of the prophecies in Matthew chapter 24. Paul, when describing true Israel in Romans 9, 10, and 11, that's what he is describing here as the church, true Israel. And that's really what Paul is developing through these 3 chapters. And then when he gets into chapter 12, he's talking about how we're transformed through Christ, how we are to behave like Christians, to live peaceably with one another. and with others, not to seek revenge. And that's the context for chapter 13, which deals with our obedience to the government, to the powers that be. And it all stems from this. When Paul is writing Romans, it is about the time, around 54 or so, maybe 55, he's writing this. It hasn't been all that long since Claudius kicked the Jews out of Rome for Judaizing, for trying to proselytize, to convert others. We are to obey the government. Peter, writing in 1 Peter 2, he's writing from Rome. Chapter 5 talks about writing from Babylon, but the idea is he's there in Rome, and he's writing this somewhere between 64 through about 66, maybe 67. So the events that we're talking about, Nero's emperor, these events are about to take place. When Peter says, honor the king, honor the emperor, he has in mind the man who's going to kill him. Remember what caused that war. It was the failure to heed the government, to pray, to sacrifice on behalf of the emperor. Do we do that? Are our political passions stronger than our religious passions? We get so focused on the government this or the government that, and our own lives, do we remember to pray for the government? Many of you have heard me joke that we are to pray for the government and to pray for our enemies. Sometimes that's two groups, sometimes that's one group. In the case of the Jews, it was one group. But we are still to do that. We are still to pray for them. God rules in the affairs of men. And we could go through passage after passage after passage after passage in the Old Testament showing how God works through various nations, various empires. It's the purpose of our service and reading last week. That's what we talked about in Ezekiel and Daniel, the minor prophets, all of this. But the upshot is that he has given time for repentance. Judgment is done collectively. Nations are judged. The world will be judged. But salvation only comes at the individual level. I cannot save you, you cannot save me. But salvation comes through Christ. He has given time for repentance. Do we take advantage of that time? Have we repented? Have we changed our mind to align with the awesome God that we talked about last week? The awesome God that works through the greatest military the world has ever seen. The measuring stick still used today to bring about his judgment. Have we done so? If you have not, you need to make that change before it's too late. When does this come? I don't know. We know it will come. Look how fast judgment came upon Jerusalem. How fast it came upon Judea. When Paul is in jail at the end of Acts, it's less than 8 years before the destruction of Jerusalem. That's not long. The last time this country did not have a president who served 8 years, was more than a generation ago. 8 years is not long. How fast? Beats me. But we are to be prepared. Do you need to make yourself right with the Lord? If you need to repent, if you need to change your mind and align it with God's will, we invite you to come.